Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States turned on Iraq with shock and awe, invasion, occupation, and an ocean of blood, time, and treasure. Then Afghanistan and economic meltdown took the spotlight, and many Americans turned away. But 120,000 U.S. troops are still in Iraq, and the country's fate is still unclear. This hour on Point, we'll talk with Saad Iskander, director of Iraq's National Library and Archives, just in from Baghdad, about his country's fate and future. You can join the conversation after all these years. Do you now see mission accomplished in Iraq? Do you see a country that can come together and thrive as U.S. troops pull out? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Turn in a moment to Saad Iskander, but joining me first today from Baghdad in Iraq is Rod Nordland, correspondent there for the New York Times. Rod, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Could you bring us up to date? First of all, Iraq's supposed to have national elections early next year. Those are tied to the planned withdrawal of U.S. troops. How does all that roll out? What's the drawdown schedule and the election schedule as far as we can see it now, Rod?
Well, the American military has said that 30 to 60 days after the Iraqis have their election, presumably January 16th, they'll review how quickly they can draw down the troop levels, which are going to stay around 120,000 until that time. So if the elections are delayed, it's pretty likely that, U.S. Troop withdrawals will be delayed. And that could have actually a direct bearing on whether we can actually send more troops to Afghanistan, if indeed that's what President Obama decides to do. A lot of the troops for Afghanistan, of course, are going to come from the surplus that we have once we start drawing down in Iraq.
What's the big calendar that the White House has said it's aiming for in terms of U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq? What are the steps, Rod?
Well, President Obama has pledged to get troop levels, to get all combat troops out of the country by the end of next August, which would leave about 50,000 troops for training and logistics support for the Iraqi military. And then by the end of 2011, to get all the rest of the troops out. Moving 70,000 troops out between January and August is no mean feat. And if it's delayed because the elections are delayed, which increasingly looks like it may well happen, then it's going to be just that much more difficult to do it on that schedule.
Would they go straight to Afghanistan from Iraq, or is this all about rotation back to the U.S. and others to Afghanistan, Rod?
Yeah, I think very few would go directly to Afghanistan unless they were here on a short tour or something. But no, what will happen is by not being replaced by other American troops, those troops can instead go to Afghanistan. So yes, it's all about the rotations and what troops are available.
So if it stays on schedule, down to 50,000 troops by next August, all out by the end of the following year, it depends on Iraqi elections, which are still up in the air in their parliament there. And what about U.S. troops now in Iraq? Are they as visible as they were? Are they? We have the sense that they spend a lot of time behind big walls. What are those 120,000 troops doing now, Rod?
Well, they're not doing very much, and they claim they're still doing a lot of missions, but from what I can see, I think a lot of those missions are very routine. It's a lot more training-oriented, definitely, but even the tempo of training of Iraqi troops has slowed down a lot because in most cases, American troops can't go outside the wire, off of their bases, unless they have permission from Iraqis, and so they have to arrange it with the Iraqis, and the Iraqi pace of doing things and their work ethic is a little more relaxed than the American one. So yes, in general, I think a whole lot less is going on.
And we're going to speak in just a moment with Saad Iskander here in our studio. But your sense of Iraqis anticipating a time when U.S. troop levels quite soon, if things stay on schedule, are much lower. Are they looking forward to that? Are they apprehensive about that? What's your sense?
Are the Iraqis apprehensive about
yes.
that? No, I don't think so. I think there's a newfound confidence in their military. And, you know, their security forces are quite large now, much bigger than ours. And their soldiers are better trained and they're very self-confident. Sometimes I think maybe they have a misplaced confidence in their abilities, but that's all part of, you know, becoming a mature force. And I think they do have a growing respect from the Iraqi public. There's no groundswell sentiment here that, oh my God, the Americans can't leave, we're going to be sunk without them. That's a thing of the past.
Rod Nordland with the New York Times in Baghdad. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
With me now in the studio is Saad Iskander. He's Director General of the Iraq National Library and Archives, which were burned and looted in April 2003. He was born to a Kurdish family in Baghdad, fled into resistance and exile as a young man, returned to Iraq in 2003 to take over the devastated library. In 2006 and 7, he wrote an online diary for the British National Library of his experiences rebuilding his library in the midst of Baghdad's brutal sectarian violence. Saad Iskander, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have you. You're just a few days out of Baghdad.
Yes.
So how do you look at your country now? Is it on a sustainable path? Is it mission accomplished time in Iraq?
No, we are at a crossroad. We don't know what will happen leading up to the elections, because yesterday the parliament failed to vote in favor of a new election law, and this will have a bad or negative effects on the future of the country.
Because it may put off the next election. What's the problem? Is this a problem of Iraqi unity? We've been told for years that, you know, maybe Iraq holds together as a country and maybe it doesn't. Is that still an open question in your mind or not?
Yes, the election law is deepening the divisions among the Iraqis. It's not just about the postponement of the delaying of the election. It's about its effect on the political force that run Iraq since 2003. So the Shiites are divided even much bigger than before. The Sunnis are divided much than before, and the same applies to the Kurdish camp.
We're going to look at this big picture. Give us a sense of your day-to-day life, in your work, in your just getting around. Is it still as dangerous as it was? You know, we know your facilities have been looted and burned extensively back when the Ba'athists were pulling out, the Americans were coming in. Rocket attacks, mortar attacks, kidnapping, assassination. Is this part of the past now? Can you drive to work and feel that you're going to come home, you know, safe and sound? Or is that still an open question?
It's yes and no. Compared to 2006 and 2007, the security situation has improved a great deal. But the threat of assassination and kidnapping is still there, and they go unreported on the media. Last month, one of my library workers were murdered for sectarian reasons, so the threat is still there. And everything depends on the goodwill of the Iraqi government and on the goodwill of the political elites. If they run or if they reach a compromise in the way they run the country, I think that we will have a promising future after 2010 elections.
But that is still an open question. On the other hand, that's quite a vision if they can pull that off.
Yes.
As you look at these factors now, we'll dig into them. But is it important now to have so many U.S. troops there? Does it matter that they're on the calendar to leave? What about the U.S. role, military role, at this point in Iraq?
I don't agree with the reporter on saying that everybody in Iraq wants the Americans to withdraw very quickly, because we are still not sure about our capability to deal with the security situation. We had the bloody Wednesday when the Ministry of Finance and Minister of Foreign Affairs were attacked and hundreds of people were killed and injured. I was in Baghdad when the two attacks took place, and I saw the chaos created in the capital. So life stopped on that day. So our security still depends on our cooperation with the U.S. forces.
Do you still see U.S. troops on the street or in the countryside, or is it Iraqi troops now, and are you confident in that force?
99% of the military presence in Iraq, in Baghdad, is Iraqi. The problem is with the deadline and the timetable. This will encourage the other forces, the forces of darkness, to attack, and this will limit the options of the Iraqi government.
Limit their options because?
Because it will not be flexible when dealing with the threat of terrorism.
So they would, if the sectarian violence comes back, then they have to sort of put up their guard, put up the walls, put up the inflexibility again.
Yes, yes. See, even Baghdad now is not stable 100%. We have Sunni quarters, it's no go area to the Shias and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a normal city.
Not a normal city, not a normal time, but do you see hope that this may work out? Does it look like it may possibly hold together, be moving into a new era, finally, with some kind of new stability?
As Iraqis, we have no choice but to be optimistic.
No choice, but then realities stare you in the face at the same time.
I know, but we must be optimistic about the future of the country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking back at Iraq this hour, its fate and future, as many Americans' attention has moved on. Not our troops yet. There are still 120,000 there, but U.S. attention moving in large part to Afghanistan. My guest in this hour is Saad Iskander, Director General of the Iraq National Library and Archives. He joins me in the studio just a couple of days out of Baghdad. Saad Iskander, listen with us, if you would, to this exchange. Here's the Iraqi president, Prime Minister Maliki, was in Washington just a few days ago. Here's President Obama, after their meeting in the Oval Office, praising the progress that's been made in Iraq, laying out a timeline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
We have seen in the last several months a consolidation of a commitment to democratic politics inside of Iraq. We are very interested, both of us, in making sure that Iraq has an election law that is completed on time so that elections can take place on time in January. That is consistent with the transition that has been taking place, and I reemphasized my commitment to Prime Minister Maliki that we will have our combat troops out of Iraq by August of next year, and all of our troops out of Iraq by 2011.
Big milestones for U.S. troops. President Obama there with him, speaking through a translator at the press conference, was Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He emphasized the importance of Iraq's economic progress.
I have also discussed with President Obama the various issues and the fact that our relations today have moved along and not only confined to the security cooperation, but today have moved to the economic and economic development and to providing prosperity for the Iraqi people.
Time for economic development and prosperity. Enough with all that security attention. We'll see. Saad Iskander is with me in the studio. We've got lots of callers coming in for you, Mr. Iskander. Greg in Camden, South Carolina, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
You pull the troops out, my prediction, next August, combat troops out of Iraq, you have utter chaos. And I say that because we are and understand that more of a democratic society here in America. I am military myself. However, these folks have not seen that, and it's something that once a force and like ours and our allied troops come out, the country goes back to utter chaos.
Greg, let me put it to our Iraqi guest, our esteemed Iraqi guest, and thank you for your call, Saad Iskander. There's a perspective from South Carolina, U.S. troops out, utter chaos.
It's a very gloomy perspective.
Yes.
To some extent, I agree that the withdrawal of the U.S. forces should depends on the maturity of the democracy in Iraq, on the advance and progress of the political process. You shouldn't put a timetable without taking into consideration the political realities on the ground in Iraq.
But if you don't lay out a timetable, the sense has always been there's no pressure for the political situation to advance, to improve.
I know. But the problem is with the regional players, Iran, Turkey, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and others. They have influence in Iraq, and the U.S. disregarded this reality. So the weaker the U.S. presence in Iraq, the stronger the role of the regional players, and these regional powers are not interested in seeing a democratic, stable Iraq.
You've said that the U.S. may already not be by any means the most important foreign player in Iraq, even now.
Yes, we have these regional players. They are intervening in every aspect of our life, from politics to culture to the economy.
So what will decide whether Iraq has a sort of critical mass of stability, unity at its core, to hold it together with those forces around?
As I said, it depends on the representative of the three communities, the Sunni and the Shia and the Kurdish community. Unfortunately, they are not mature enough to see the bright future of Iraq. Iraq is a very wealthy country. If we invest in the economy, we will create the infrastructure for democracy. Democracy in the third world countries need a very strong economy that people will vote not according to their religious or their ethnic background. They will vote according to their interest. Unfortunately, in Iraq, what we see is a communal voting. Sunnis vote in favor of Sunni political parties, and the same applies to the Kurds and the Shiis.
Is your prime minister leading out of that? I mean, there's been some talk of Iraqis moving toward a time when interests begin to trump tribe or ethnic or communal affiliation. Is there significant evidence of that happening?
No, it's quite the opposite. The prime minister is now mobilizing Arab tribes and using them as a political force, and from time to time, he participated in tribal meetings and gatherings and trying to win their support.
Greg may be gloomy in his call, but what about you? You live there. You know it firsthand. He, on the spectrum of utter chaos or something better, where do you fall in your expectations?
We still have time to the general election of 2010. And again, it depends on the goodwills of these representatives of the three communities. And at the end, I think they will reach a compromise on what democratic, because a lot of people here don't know the argument and the debate among the Iraqis about the form of government we need in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Maliki and the Shias want a democracy based on the role of majority. Mm-hmm. The Kurds want a democracy based on the role of power sharing, mm-hmm. because Iraq is not mature enough to be run one vote, one man, one vote, mm-hmm. because we are very divided society. So if we adopt the system based on majoritarian rule, that means the Shi'i will monopolize the state, the government, and the army.
Does that mean that Kurds and Sunni are then allies in this? Because the Sunni, having governed for so long, are clearly a minority. Are they in the same camp then as the Kurds?
This is a return to the old Iraq. The old Iraq was based on excluding others from power sharing. Mm-hmm. So we are going back, but the minority will be a majority.
The minority will be, what do you mean by that? Sunni
the
plus
Sunni,
Kurd?
Yeah, the Sunni minority who ruled the country mm-hmm. for hundreds of years mm-hmm. will be replaced with the Shia majority. So we did nothing, we changed nothing. So we will have communities that will be suppressed by the majority. And democracy is not about suppressing minorities, it's about protecting minorities.
Let's go to Alice in Canton, Massachusetts. Alice, you're on the air with Saad Iskander.
How you doing, Tom?
Pretty well.
I want to tell you that I extremely resent the way these questions are being framed, is that pseudo-superior, we are the great American democracy, and we have the right to dictate to the Iraqis, a country we invaded immorally, we have the right to even ask them to be a democracy. We're not a democracy. We are ruled by corporations. So the arrogance implicit in the way these questions are framed just drives me crazy. So here's my question to your friend there.
Mm-hmm.
In view of the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Iraqis we killed immorally and illegally, how many Iraqis, having lost their loved ones, are now wonderfully set up to try and find some training in how to be a terrorist? I would be doing that. If the Iraqis came over here and did to my family what we did to them, I'd be all set to get my revenge, and I wouldn't blame them a bit.
Alice, let me humbly put that to my guest here, Saad Iskander. Alice doesn't want to even hear questions from an American to Iraqis about how are you doing, but we do still have 120,000 troops there, and that means something. She doesn't like what it means. Many don't. But what about her core question about Iraqis' attitude after this long, terrible experience?
Yes, she should has to know that Iraq society is divided along ethnic and religious lines, and every community has an attitude towards the Americans different from the other communities. We are not united in the way that we saw the invasion. Some of us saw the invasion as a liberation, like Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. And some others, especially those who were in power during Saddam Hussein, they opposed the invasion. The Shiites and the Kurds saw it as an opportunity to have a more democratic regime in Iraq. So the reaction of the people of Iraq is not one, it's not united, and it depends on their interests.
Do you see the realities in the country being harnessed in such a way that it may dampen the anger Alice imagines must be there in many quarters? The president and Prime Minister Maliki said, well, we're moving from security issues now to issues of economy and prosperity. Does that line up with reality there as you see it? Are Iraqis turning back to making a living, to living without bombs, to thinking about, you know, the future and investments in their families?
They should have invested in the economy long time ago, not now, because the economy affects the political scene in Iraq. A lot of unemployed people are recruited by the Baathists, by the Qaeda. They pay them money to carry out terrorist attacks, and we have a lot of evidence of that. So I think investment in the economy, investment in cultural and educational system will lead to a more stable Iraq, more democratic Iraq.
Let's get a call from Knoxville, Tennessee. Arwash. Arwash, you're on the air with Saad Iskander.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Iskander. So your previous caller stole a bit of my thunder, but I apologize if some of this is redundant. But really my question is, you know, following the events of September 11th, we had 3,000-plus civilian innocent deaths here in the United States. And that was the impetus. As a result of that, the United States, pretty much we can say, has changed the landscape of the world. It's invaded countries. It has provided false pretext, false reasons for invading a sovereign country. And how do we reconcile that we have more than, at some estimates, well over a million innocent civilian deaths in this ancient, beautiful country that has been under turmoil for so many years, so many innocent deaths? How do we reconcile that with the results that we're seeing today? How do we reconcile the misery that's been administered to these people, and I should say the lack of results, really?
Let us pick it up. Thank you for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Saad Iskander, how do you respond to that question, that framing of Iraq's situation?
I don't know if Iraqis lost 1 million lives during the invasion or after. This is a huge number. I don't think this reflects the realities on the ground. This is one. Second, the number of the people who killed under Saddam Hussein's were in millions during the Iraq-Iran war. The civil war in Kurdistan, the invasion of Kuwait, and during the chaotic period of the uprising in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
So Saddam's responsible for the death of millions of Iraqis directly through war of aggressions, through suppression of the opposition and suppression of the Kurds. After the invasion, that I admit that the U.S. policymakers made a lot of mistakes, like not rebuilding the Iraqi army very quickly, and the delay in transferring power to the Iraqis, and in learning the lessons from the previous invasion, the British invasion, that the British, when they came to Iraq, they put more emphasis on secularism when they built a new country which called Iraq. Iraq was established in 1921 as a British project. The first thing that the British did, they invested in secularism. They built
meaning what exactly in Iraq?
Schools, mm-hmm. secular schools. We didn't mm-hmm. have secular schools before the First World War. Mm-hmm. We did not have museums, secular libraries in Iraq.
Your own institution comes from that time.
So the British, they did it as a means to serve their interests, but at the long run, we benefited from this secularism. Unfortunately, Iraq under Saddam Hussein was a secular state.
Mm-hmm.
After April 2003, it's not a secular state anymore.
Meaning the Americans did not have that same emphasis?
They didn't pay attention to secularism in Iraq at cultural and educational levels.
And the consequences of that, or the evidence of that?
The evidence that the Islamists are in control of the education and higher education and all cultural institutions. We have the removal of Saddam created several vacuums, not just security vacuums,
mm-hmm.
cultural and educational vacuums. So the religious forces, they fill the vacuums in the cultural field and the educational field. So we need to readdress that, to put more emphasis on secularism.
Did the Americans just ignore that situation, or did they encourage the religious communities to step into these roles?
I think they ignored, or they didn't see it as important. They saw that the political process is the most important. They should invest in the political parties and political factions rather than investing in the institutions which really will be the infrastructure of democracy.
And that religious hold, it sounds as though you're saying, will make it perhaps more difficult to get to the goal that you have in mind of a democratic and sort of secular commons in the country.
Yes. We have to bear in mind that the religious forces are not the democratic forces, unlike the Christian political forces in the West. There is no transformation from undemocratic force to democratic force, not the Maliki nor the other parties. They are not democratic political forces. So we need to strengthen the institutions of the state to redefine their roles and tasks, to modernize them in a way that they could help with this transition from dictatorship to democracy.
Can a politician in Iraq win with that message, with that campaign slogan?
No, but the American could have helped with that.
Could have. We're beginning to put this in the past tense. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back at Iraq this hour, its fate and future, as the attention of many Americans has moved on, though not U.S. troops yet. 120,000 still there, down to 50,000, we're told, if everything goes to schedule by the end of next summer. My guest is Saad Iskander, Director General of the Iraq National Library and Archives. He joins me in the studios just a couple of days out of Baghdad. Big issue for you personally in your role at the National Library and Archives has been Iraqi archives. Many were destroyed, some by Saddam's Ba'athists in the last days of his regime and its collapse, others in the invasion, others just taken out wholesale in large volume by Americans at a certain point in the process. The Iraqi Memory Foundation, Kanan Makia's group, took many of them to the Hoover Institution in California, where they remain. You've been campaigning to bring those back to Iraq. Why, and how's it going?
I think these records are extremely important for us as Iraqis. First, we need these records for the purpose of transitional justice in Iraq. We have millions of victims. We need information to compensate these victims, to requalifying, to recognize their sufferings. We need these records for the project of national reconciliation. You cannot have a national reconciliation without these records. We have these records to understand our bitter past. We need to learn or to draw lessons from what happened during the old Iraq and to prevent the reemergence of a new dictatorship. We need to study ourselves because we changed a lot. We don't know to what extent that Saddam Hussein's regime changed people's mentality and behavior. So these records are important for Iraqis for a lot of reasons. That's why I waged my campaign since 2004 for the retrieval of these records. And the Iraqis should decide how to use them according to a series of progressive legislation that will not harm anybody, but they will be used in lawful, logical, and human way.
What's the volume of Iraqi archives, records being held outside Iraq now in the United States?
Tens of millions of records. The Pentagon admitted that it has 48,000 containers of Iraqi records.
Like shipping containers?
Yes.
The huge shipping containers. Yes. Why were they taken out in the first place?
The Pentagon and other forces or ministries have their own reasons. One was to find a justification for the invasion. Among these records, they wanted to see if there was a link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam, and they wanted to find evidence on the weapons of mass destructions. And apart from all of that, I think they wanted to know the details of every influential Iraqi politician.
To have their background, maybe
yes.
To put leverage on them to cooperate.
Yes.
And what's the justification that's being given for them still being held now?
They don't give any justification.
Kanan Makia was a fellow Iraqi exile. Like you, he lived for years in exile, worked at Brandeis and near us here, and helped get these to California. What does he say to you when you say, let's take these home?
He always said that Iraq is not safe enough so that he could return this record to Iraq.
Is it safe enough?
Yes, because we are functioning in Iraq. The National Archive is functioning in Iraq. And we are based in the red zone of Baghdad, not in the green zone, like his office. His office was in the green zone next to the U.S.
Behind
embassy.
Behind the fence, the wire,
yes.
The wall, the
so
bomb.
So how I can serve the cause of the archives and the records, and he cannot do that while he enjoying the support of the State Department and other U.S. quarters.
The Society of American Archivists and the Association of Canadian Archivists have put out a joint statement calling the taking these documents an act of pillage. Pillage. What are your legal rights here when it comes to the historical records of Iraq?
They are Iraqis, and they should be considered as part of our documentary heritage. And records are considered to be part of the cultural heritage of any country, and even the United States admits that. They cannot deny these facts. The victims have the right to have access to the records that covered affected their lives.
Victims of?
Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. The prisoners, those who lost their lives, their relatives, those who were tortured by Saddam Hussein, those who lost their properties, those who lost their Iraqi nationality because of Saddam's policy. So we need these records, and they are Iraqi properties, according to international convention and according to logic.
Amy's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Amy, you're on the air with Saad Iskander.
Yes, hi. I'm an archivist, and actually Mr. Iskander just talked to my alma mater, Simmons, the other day. And I wanted to ask a little bit about, for him to hear what he had to say about the identity of Iraqis related to the papers and the materials that have been lost, you know, how he sees their realization of the losses after this war and after Saddam's reign, you know, as they pull themselves together again and create a cultural identity again, you know, if the loss of these materials, or how he sees the loss of these materials affecting their rebuilding of an identity and of a culture. And the other question I had is, I know there was a task force from the American military helping to recover some of the lost, particularly objects from the museum, and I was curious if that task force is still working and if they've recovered much of what had been looted and, yeah. Well,
and so much was lost. We'll come to that, but first to this question, maybe you could take us back and, you know, to look at, I mean, you talked about the mentality and behavior of Iraqis. Amy asks about the identity of Iraqis. If you could sort of take us through those Saddam years, your sense of what happened to the Iraqi identity then. And now I guess we have to talk about the U.S. occupation or invasion years. It's not a small number of years. What about the evolution of Iraq's cultural identity then? Where does it stand now? And how does this, effort to get the archives back figure in here?
As I said earlier, that Iraq was established in 1921 as a new state emerged in the Middle East in post-First World War. And it was up to the Iraqi elites to create an identity, a national identity, will include all the ethnic and religious communities. Unfortunately, those who ruled Iraq between 1921 and 2003 emphasized the Arab nature of Iraq, the Sunni nature of Iraq, and pan-Arabist nature of Iraq. So in this way, they excluded the majority, the Kurds and the Shia.
Mm-hmm.
So Iraq failed as a state, failed to form this identity that we all Iraqis, regardless of our ethnic and religious backgrounds. The post-invasion is a good opportunity to rebuild a true national identity, a true historical memory, because all the historical memory were prepared by those who were loyal to the state, not reflecting the realities on the ground. So these records will help us to understand our past and to even forge a new cultural identity, to the national cultural identity. We have subcultures in Iraq which are predominant, and they dominating the life. But we need these subcultures to play a constructive role, to be into interactive relations, so that a new national identity, new culture, a new national culture emerge. So these records and the items of the museum play a significant role in forming a new identity, because these are secular items. We need a secular identity, not a religious identity, for the new Iraq.
Some inside, outside Iraq have looked at this. Joe Biden, before he was vice president, looked and, you know, said, I don't think this can ever really hold together. I mean, the British kind of created this. It's not really an organic unity. Maybe Iraqis should let it fall apart. Who fights for it? Or who do Iraqis value the pan-Iraqi unity that they've inherited?
As I said, the political elite which controlled power for decades, they did not put emphasis on pan-Iraqism. Mm-hmm. They put emphasis on pan-Arabism. So the Shiis and the Kurds did not allow to play a constructive role in the state, in government, and in society. That's why Iraq failed as a state.
But will it succeed? Does it have the desire? Does it have enough gravitation pulling these communities together to succeed ultimately?
I think Iraq's situation is like that of Belgium. You need the main ethnic groups to compromise and to understand and to admit the realities on the ground that Iraq cannot be dominated by one group. It should be administered by the three groups in the interest of all Iraqis, at least 20 years to come. After that, when everybody is happy with the situation and we could trust each other. The problem is that trusting each other, the Kurds don't trust the Shiites don't trust the Sunnis. So we need a power sharing period, 20, 15 years. After that, when the trust is there, we can change the system from power sharing to role of majority, democracy based on the role of majority.
And to Amy's question, it's not your institute, nevertheless, the objects of the museum, ancient from the great culture of Tigris and Euphrates. How much of that has been recovered? Was it just lost forever in the chaos of the invasion?
Ironically, the Americans are playing a very positive role in retrieving all these missing items, unlike their attitudes towards the issue of records.
There's not as much leverage or political leverage in an object as in the records of someone's personal history.
Yes. They're playing a very constructive role, and they are helping the Iraqis to retrieve all these missing items. So far, we received it's difficult to pinpoint a number. It's in thousands, but a huge number of these items is still missing.
Let's get a call from Nashville and Mark. Mark, you're on the air with Saad Iskander. Hello, Mark, are you there? It looks like we lost Mark, but I see that the gist of his question here was, you know, he's looking for a bottom line. The invasion of Iraq by the United States with all of its consequences. You're a highly educated man in an important position in Iraq. Do you look back on it, as some of our callers have today, as an unmitigated disaster, tragedy, calamity? Or do you look at it as those who so bitterly fought against Saddam, wanted him out, and see some value in that? When you personally, a wise man, put this invasion on the scales of justice, humanity, history, how do you look at it now?
I look at it as a price we have to pay, because great changes always lead to great suffering, like in the French Revolution, in the Iranian Revolution, in a lot of countries, the transition to from dictatorship to democracy was not easy and always led to bloodshed. So I see it from that perspective, and what happened in Iraq is part of this, because we have a minority which was not willing to give up its privileges, and we have a majority that is fighting to have access to power and to control. So we need a period that both sides should understand that the majority cannot rule like the minority did in the past, and the minority should recognize that the fact that when they ruled the country, they caused a lot of suffering to the others. So we need a point when both sides reach this point and understand that Iraq is a home to all Iraqis, regardless of their religious or ethnic backgrounds.
Yourself, you have a Kurdish background, though from Baghdad, not from the north, where so many Kurds are now. What about in your own extended family? Do they share, your own relatives, share your, what I'm hearing is your desire for this power sharing, for this everyone in it together in Iraq, or are they divided on that? Not all Kurds seem to be interested in that.
I am a member of a small Kurdish community, which is Shia and Kurdish at the same time. So we were oppressed under Saddam Hussein for two reasons.
Both angles.
And the third angle, factor was we were secular and left-wing people. So Saddam Hussein hated us for three reasons, being Kurdish, being Shia, being those who oppose his regime. So about 80% of our community were destroyed. Their properties were confiscated.
Is it the Baghdadi Filis?
Yes.
Is the group's identification? Yeah.
Yes. And we are now from a very, very tiny minority in Baghdad, and we don't have an influence like we did during the 60s and the 50s. We played a very constructive role in the economy of the country, in the culture of the country.
Like it or not, the United States stepped in big. When you look ahead, over the next, 8 years, what role do you wish for the U.S. in your country? Any? Some? What?
It's, you know, America is a great country, and all other countries are trying to be friend of America. This is the reality of the situation. Even the Arab Middle East, on the media, they're criticizing America for siding with Israel. But if you ask any young Arab, he will say, I want to go to America to finish my higher education. And we want a society similar to the one in America. We need to benefit from our relations with the America, culturally, economically, financially, because we need a model to follow. I'm not talking about the negative aspect of U.S. foreign policy. I'm talking about the internal life, how you administer your society, how your culture is flourishing, why America was able to separate its culture throughout the world. So we need to benefit from that relation for our own benefit.
Still an open mind there. You're a remarkably generous generous soul, Asad Iskander, and I appreciate that. And in the few seconds we have, your word to those who still hold Iraqi documents in the United States?
Please return these records. It's the rights of the victims. You are violating. Saddam violated their rights for decades, and you are doing the same.
Asad Iskander, Director General of the Iraq National Library and Archives, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me on your program. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.